Amanda.
Please be seated. Call our third case for today, 05-18-1829, State v. Herenda Enterprises, Inc. And we'll first hear from the Assistant Attorney General representing the State of Wisconsin Council.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Jeff Kubrishek. I'm Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin, the plaintiff, respondent, petitioner in this appeal. This afternoon, I'm going to be confining my argument to the single issue that the court accepted for review in its order granting review, the single issue of whether or not the language contained in a federal EPA administrative rule concerning asbestos content in multi-layered building materials as adopted by the State of Wisconsin, is sufficiently unclear as to justify reliance on two EPA published guidance documents in construing the terms of the rule. It's a mouthful, I understand. The first question, of course, is the regulation unclear? And this is significant because unless the court can find that the language of the rule is unclear, the court cannot subsequently rely on EPA guidance in terms of determining how the rule should be interpreted. The single sentence we're talking about, and this is the only sentence that concerns in the vast regulations concerning asbestos removal and proper asbestos removal and the regulations concerning asbestos removal, the only sentence that addresses multi-layered situations is when discrete strata are identified, each is treated as a separate material so that fibers are first identified and quantified in that layer only, and then the results for each layer are combined to yield an estimate of the asbestos content for the whole sample.
What does that mean?
Well, the state would submit that it is sufficiently unclear that you can't tell what it means from just that language. And I think the most telling thing, Your Honors, that suggests that it's unclear is that the EPA has essentially made a finding of fact that it's unclear. In its 1995 guidance, it discussed the fact that the reason it is issuing the guidance is because the industry needed some clarification as to how these rules apply. And they discussed the fact that this lack of clarity was causing problems. And they even discussed why they thought the rule that they adopted was causing problems, and that's because the rule, in a sense, didn't change. If read one way, that some people had been misinterpreting it, according to the EPA, it would change past practice. Because the past practice before the adoption of the interim method was that there was no allowance for dilution. You couldn't use materials that didn't contain asbestos and dilute the percentage of layers that did contain asbestos. That was the regulation. Essentially, the EPA said, well, that's what was to be written, and that we thought we wrote that, but people have been construing it wrong. We're going to clarify this. And they explained kind of how it kind of came about. And how it came about is that generally when you have, say, three layers of plaster, and I'm going to use plaster, it could be anything, but I'm going to use plaster because this case involves plaster. Say you have three layers of plaster. Most businesses want to save money, so they don't want to test each individual layer when they have a suspicion that there's more than 1% asbestos in it. So what they do is they take a sample, core sample, all the way through each, grind it up, look at it. If it's more than 1%, you're out. You only do one sample then. It's covered. It's regulated. It has to be removed properly. What happens is if there's less than 1%, then they have to go back and test every individual layer. Because just because it's less than 1%, there may be one layer that's more than 1%. And so that was past practice. That's essentially what they were trying to accomplish by writing the rule the way they did. The rule is unclear. EPA has said it. They explained why it kind of came about. The rule, I think, is truly unclear. Specifically, one of the arguments that was made before the trial court and the argument that the trial court accepted. The rule, when you just read it, it's as black-letterly written, doesn't tell you which portion of the sentence, the individual layers, or the combined layers is the term, that you apply to that 1% standard. It doesn't say which one. I didn't make this argument in my brief because the trial court didn't think of this argument until after I wrote my brief, but the trial court found, well, it didn't say which one you apply the 1% standard to. I think you can read that to say that you apply the 1% standard to both. That if either one of those is over 1%, either the combined number or an individual layer is over 1%, it's covered. That's how ambiguous I think this language is. There's nothing to suggest which of those analyses, combined or individual, you apply the 1% standard to.
So what does the 95 interpretation say?
The 95 interpretation makes it absolutely clear that you have to look at every individual layer. And if any one individual layer is more than 1% asbestos by area, then it falls into the regulated material and it must be properly removed using proper techniques. You know, also, the phrase in the second sentence uses the word combined. You know, when I went to grade school and you combined numbers or fractions, you added them. You didn't average them, you added them. You added them up. You combined the fractions, you added them. Combined numbers, you added them. It uses the term combine. It doesn't talk about any, that doesn't use the word average. It doesn't suggest the word average. It's just unclear in that regard.
But where does the average come from?
The average.
The averaging, the as opposed to the adding or other methods or modes of combining.
Well, I think it became from the past practice. As I suggested, you don't even average it. What it talks about is you take the layers, you grind them up, you look at it, that gives you an average. But it doesn't talk about averaging them because it's just that if that ground up sample is over 1%, it, by definition, one of those layers is over 1%. There's just no question about it. And so that was a time-saving method that had been used. As I said, basically, the rule as written sort of has the analysis process switched.
Choosing 1%, frankly, seems odd to me. I mean, I know it's a safety measure, but, you know, if you have a huge, big chunk of material, even if there's only one strata, you're less apt to have 1% asbestos in it than if you have a layer of paint which also has asbestos in it. And so is it 1% of volume? Is it 1% by weight of the sample? 1% of what?
I mean, well, as I point out, there's a footnote on page 12 of my brief that cites the EPA regulation. And the answer to the question is it's by area.
By area.
By area. And why that doesn't matter is this. How do I explain? When you're looking at each individual layer, you can look at the area, and if one area is over 1% and it's a homogeneous substance, the average is over 1% for that limited area. So it really isn't looking at averages. It looks at, this purely doesn't look at percentages. It looks at percentages of areas, assuming that it's a homogeneous substance, a homogeneous layer. One of the things, you know, the Court of Appeals did in when reading their opinion, it was a portion of the opinion that I conclude they didn't get it. And this is the portion of the opinion when...
Then you better go slowly.
At one point in my argument before the Court of Appeals, and they address this in their decision, I suggest that it's absurd. It results in an absurdity if you allow the averaging or the dilution of the various layers. And the reason, and I gave an example of a half inch of plaster containing 5% asbestos attached to 5 layers of wallpaper. And if you would consider each individual layer, you have 6 layers. You divide that 5% by 6, and you've got less than 1%. But how in the world is a worker coming up with a hammer, hitting that wall to knock it down, how is that any safer having the wallpaper attached to it? It's 5% asbestos. It wouldn't matter one way or the other to that worker's health, safety, and well-being, whether it's attached to five layers or wallpaper at all. That's because, in fact, it doesn't dilute when you demolish something. It doesn't all fall apart all at once and fall in a great mass of diluted material. And I don't want to criticize the Court of Appeals opinion, but the Court of Appeals opinion said, well, you know, that's an interesting example, but what about the contrary to that? What happens when you have asbestos paint painted on 12 inches of concrete? How is that dangerous? My point is that when you demolish that concrete structure, it doesn't just dilute altogether all at once. The guy walks up to it with a hammer, or he walks up to it with a wrecking ball, and it hits the outside layer first, and that's when the asbestos fibers disperse. I mean, you can't say it dilutes it. It doesn't dilute it. I mean, it doesn't work that way.
Why?
And that's when I thought, man, did I blow this? They didn't get it. You know, maybe it's my fault. I don't know. But my example, I thought, made good sense. But the contrary, it means that there's a lack of understanding, because that's not how construction works. You just can't knock a wall down and it all disperses into an average.
I ask you about Wisconsin Statute 285-87. Penalties for violating air pollution.
Okay, I'm very familiar with that, although I haven't looked at it in a few years. But
That's the statute that governs the penalties in this case?
Correct. This is under the civil section.
Civil section. Could there be a criminal violation?
Yes, indeed. Our office, the state of Wisconsin, has prosecuted numerous criminal actions involving asbestos removal. When you have an intentional violation, situations where workers come to the DNR explaining that they were told not to wet the asbestos-containing material because it takes much longer to take it down when it's wetted, or not encapsulate, or not put up protective barriers, not using negative air, that would be a criminal situation where normally you wouldn't prosecute the worker. You'd end up prosecuting either the company or the manager.
How do you square that with your proposition that the statute or that the regulation is just ambiguous?
I think it's ambiguous until you look at the clarifications. For example, the California case that the court has looked at, it was cited to the court, the Southern San Diego Electric and Natural Gas, or Gas and Electric, one of the two, that case was a criminal case. It was prosecuted as a criminal case. This, of course, is a civil case. And I do believe that
Wisconsin adopted the federal regulation before the clarification, isn't that right?
Correct.
How was it interpreted before the clarifications?
As pointed out in the 95 clarifications, the practice, industry-wide practice, known to everyone, was that you didn't dilute asbestos. That layer, multi-layers did not end up resulting in a dilution of the percentage of asbestos in terms of comparison to that 1% standard.
You don't think a reasonable person could read the regulation basically the way the Court of Appeals read it?
I truly, for the various aspects that I've gone through here, and I still want to talk about a few more on why I think it's confusing, I do not believe so. I'm not a Philadelphia lawyer, as they say, but I remember the first time I read it, I go, what is that? Because of the fact that there's no discussion of which section the 1% applies to, and because of the fact that combined, what does that mean? You go through that, and it doesn't seem to make that type of sense.
So three judges on the Court of Appeals and the United States District Judge, their reading of this regulation is just completely unreasonable.
Well, I'm not going to call anybody completely unreasonable. But I would say that
just unreasonable?
To be honest with you, the Court of Appeals didn't address the word combined and told me what that meant. They didn't tell me how they knew the 1% applied to one portion of the sentence or the other.
Let me ask you this. The language in the regulation talks about, and then the results for each layer are combined to yield an estimate of asbestos content for the whole sample. In the 1995 clarification, talks about and results were not allowed to be combined to determine average asbestos content.
Are they talking about prior practice at that time?
Well, I think
I don't know which section of the 95.
It's talking about this clarification in 94, trying to explain.
Okay.
It seems to me these two are diametrically opposite to each other.
When you talk about whole sample, I think it is diametrically opposed to individual sample. But let me ask you, when you talk about each layer there, you said each layers are combined. Are those just the layers with asbestos in it, or did they include layers that don't have asbestos in it? I don't think you can tell when you read this which layers they're talking about. That was another point I was going to make about how unclear this is. You tell me when they speak. I mean, I'm not going to put you on the spot, obviously. But
oh, go ahead.
It's always nice to ask questions from out there, right?
That's right. Does anyone else have any questions?
That's what I mean. That's an argument again I didn't make in my brief. It's kind of weird. You kind of drop this case for 6 months. You pick it up again. You go, well, it's kind of a whole new view. I don't think you can tell which layers you combine. Because it doesn't say that you compare the layers with asbestos in it, or it doesn't say you compare all the layers. It just says compare the layers.
Seems to me it's the discrete strata that you combine.
Okay, but it talks about separate. Okay, each is treated as separate material so that the fibers are identified and quantified in that layer. So it's kind of saying you got to have asbestos fibers in the layer to count it. Get my drift? I mean, I'm not. That's what I've done. It's very, very unclear.
Who would want to prosecute people criminally on this?
Well, obviously, there's a judge. Me personally, there's a judgment issue that comes into it. I think it is it's sufficiently unclear that it allows the court to look at the guidance. And I think we have to talk about this case and the fact that this is a civil case.
Does the fact that the statute is ambiguous, does it make it void for vagueness for criminal prosecution?
In my brief, again, that was an issue that wasn't in my petition and accepted for review. I did address it in my reply brief because I at that point, I just decided to address all the issues that were raised. It is not, because if you look at the guidance, it tells you what the rule may be. It's published guidance. The guidance tells you what the rule says. I mean, it's sufficient that if you can find the rule, you should be able to find the guidance. These rules are quite well hidden, trust me, I know. That, I think, steps have been made to make it not void for vagueness. It is unclear. Otherwise, we would never be construing rules by looking at guidance if the void for vagueness rule made all of those rules vague.
Sir, but we don't have to get to the criminal question in this case at all, do we? I mean, we don't have to decide that.
Correct.
Whether it's void for vagueness or not, we're just looking at whether it's properly interpreted.
That would be my position. But I was willing to address that issue because I had dealt with criminal asbestos cases before.
Thank you.
This is a safety rule, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So if you're looking at it as a safety rule, does it make sense to combine everything and then say, is this hole combined, all the layers in this wall combined are less than 1%? Does that make sense safety-wise when you've got...
As I point out in my examples, it makes absolutely no sense. One of the things I argued in my brief is that this court might either want to consider adopting a policy or at least in this case, particularly pay attention to agency guidance documents because of the safety factor. I mean, this is a material, asbestos fibers, that, you know, the main disease you get from it is mesothelioma. Mesothelioma is combined with smoking is basically a death sentence, I mean, putting it bluntly. Very, very small percentage of individuals getting this disease live. The problem is you don't know you had it until a gestation period of 5 to 20 years after you're exposed. And you don't even know where you got it. The local Dane County judge had mesothelioma. Lord knows where that exposure was. Warren Zevon, a rock star, recently died of that. He believed he got it 20 years earlier working in factories. It basically is a death sentence. This is a huge safety factor. And you know, I think that courts ought to give heightened protections or heightened agency abilities to provide guidance when you're dealing with that, and I'd urge the court to adopt that.
This is an incorporation by reference case.
Yes.
What are the cases say about incorporation by reference where the issue, the law to which reference is made, keeps changing? I mean, this goes back to what Justice Prosser asked you. The agency adopted the federal regulation in what, 1990?
I believe that the most recent amendment would be about 1990. Originally, I think it goes back to the earlier 80s.
Okay. But it was 93 and 95 when you have these, what you claim are interpretive.
94 and 95.
So my question is, you know, this is not the only statute or book or standard that's been incorporated by reference. And what's the general rule? Do you incorporate all future changes too?
Well, I don't think this is a change. This is an interpretation. I clearly would not submit that it's a change.
Future interpretations.
It's my understanding that clarifications are part of the adoption process. When you adopt the rules, you surely ought to adopt the clarifications because it only makes sense. One of the things I want to point out is that some might say, well, you know, what about this clarification? It came many, many years after the rule was adopted. What's the story here? First, remember, there was a past practice. Even today, the accredited labs, the labs that are accredited by the National Voluntary Accreditation Program, NAVLAP, all of those labs are directed by the rules of NAVLAP to follow the guidance documents. And, you know, you say, why don't they quick change the rule? Maybe in light of that San Diego case. There's really not a problem in the industry because the industry knows this. I mean, the industry follows the guidelines. And that, you know, there's not the sense of urgency there that one might suspect that there would be.
This company didn't.
I beg your pardon?
This company isn't following him.
Well, I'm not so sure that this company wouldn't follow them. I believe this company sent their original samples to a lab. And again, I can only speculate on this. I don't know what the problem was. That's all I know is that the company sent some samples to their lab. The city of Milwaukee took samples of the same general area, found asbestos. The state did the same thing, found asbestos. The split samples by Horrenda, when they sent them off for retest by layer, found asbestos. I can't tell you why that first set of samples didn't come back. And the reason is because either maybe they took samples at different spots. I don't know. Maybe they didn't test for layers. I can't tell you.
Maybe when they ground it up, they diluted it, right?
Exactly. Maybe they combined. I don't know. That's not the state's. It's a strict liability case. We find asbestos, there's a violation. It's not my job to explain why those layers were found to not contain asbestos. And that's one of the arguments that was also made that I did respond to in my reply brief.
How can it be strict liability when the test results vary on the same sample?
Well, exactly that. This is a statute that involves very strict liability. For example, in this case, the owner of the property, who had nothing to do with taking the samples, had nothing to do with selecting the lab, had nothing to do with the removal, was liable under the statute, strict liability. That's how serious the federal government takes this. This is how serious the state of Wisconsin takes it. The state settled with the owner of the building, which was the Wisconsin Center District. The state settled with that entity. The state settled with the general contractor, who had nothing to do with taking the samples. They hired Horrenda. That's what they did wrong. I mean, that's it. I mean, they really didn't do anything wrong. But they're strictly liable under this statute. You're not allowed to hire for the problem, if you wouldn't do that, owners of buildings would hire the fly-by-night company and put it all on them. You know, the fly-by-night company comes in, does a bad job, and says, whoop, it's not our fault. I notice my red light is on. Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mark W. Rattan, representing Horrenda Enterprises.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. My name is Mark Rattan. I represent Horrenda Enterprises, Incorporated. I have an oral argument prepared here, but in listening to Mr. Grbeshek, I kind of rewrote a lot of it while I was listening to him because I want to respond to some things. And so I'll start by saying that there are two fundamental fallacies in the state's argument when he says we can't tell what it means from the language in the statute. And that was almost a direct quote that Mr. Grbeshek made in response to Justice Abrahamson's questions. And first of all, you can tell what it means because it's plain on the face. Second of all, if you look in the record of this case, the whole idea that you can't tell what this regulation means from on the face, that statement is totally inconsistent with the record. The state's own witness, John Knight, who did some of the asbestos testing, I think, for the April 4, 2002 samples, testified that everybody in the industry knew exactly what that meant. That meant that you get a separate result for each layer and you combine the results for each layer and average them out even if a layer is zero.
But you just said two different things. You said you combine them and you average them. Now, as I understand the regulation uses the word combine. Where do you get averaging from?
From the record in this case and from the EPA's own publications that I cited in my brief where and all you have to do is look at Mr. Knight's testimony because I took his deposition and I walked him through it. And by combine, he clearly testified, here's what we do. We get a percent result for each layer. You add them up, you average them, and he said you do factor in the volume of each layer, I believe. I can't remember if he said volume or something else. But you do consider the thickness of each layer. And he was very clear on that. And there's nothing in the record to contradict that. And the EPA in its publications that I cited in my brief specifically said, under past practice, and I think they're referring to November of 1990 forward, under past practice, you would combine the layers and a layer that previously a composite result that would say no asbestos now, under our quote clarification, any one layer will result in a finding that it's asbestos, and therefore the whole sample has to be treated as asbestos. That's a complete departure from what the regulation actually says. That's completely clear on its face.
Counsel, with regard to clear on its face, I know Justice Prosser asked about the interpretation by the three judges of the Court of Appeals. You know, they found that it was clear on its face. One of the things that concerns me is, why did they need to have clarifications if it was so clear? I look at the, and hopefully you can respond to this, I look at the January 1994 clarification, and it says in part, the Environmental Protection Agency has received many questions about analyzing multi-layered systems for application. And so they're receiving many questions, and I read more, but all of a sudden I can't see it quite as clearly as I'd like to. But the bigger print is in the 1995. And it says, In its clarification, the agency has learned that some of the regulated community have further questions concerning the analysis of samples, which may contain multiple layers, any or all of which may be asbestos-containing, et cetera. So both 94 and 95, they talk about questions continuing from the regulatory community. The obvious question is, if it was so clear, why are they having so many questions? Frequent questions is what they say. Because these questions, and I'm reading now from the 95, because these questions are frequently asked, EPA makes this clarification. If it's so clear, how come we've got two clarifications and a lot of frequently asked questions?
Well, our position is that the clarifications are an attempt to rewrite the rule without rulemaking.
So is it your position that they are saying something untrue when they say that there are frequent questions from the regulated community about the analysis of samples? Are you saying that that's an untrue statement made to manipulate the situation so that they can rewrite it?
Not having taken any of their depositions, I can't say. And I don't accuse people of saying something untrue unless I've deposed them or cross-examined them and I actually have evidence. What I can tell you, Your Honor, is that from the cases cited in my brief, it is not at all unusual for an agency to try to avoid rulemaking by essentially rewriting a rule under a guise of, well, this is really just a clarification.
Well, let me ask again. Are you saying that they are being less than forthright? How's that? That's a little softer. When they say they're getting a lot of questions regarding this.
I don't know, because I don't know what went into them. I do know from the record in this case that as far as the state's own tester was concerned, Mr. Knight, that there was nothing in his eyes that was unclear about this. And in terms of the three court of appeals judges and the judge in the Southern District of California, there was no lack of clarity. I can't tell what...
That case, maybe I was wrong, because the San Diego case is the judge not being so sure that the language was clear, but regardless of whether it was clear, then the judge had concerns regarding the clarifications didn't go through the rulemaking process. And it wasn't, so I mean, I interpreted as did the circuit court judge in this case to be, the language was unclear. San Diego district court judge, the language wasn't clear. But the San Diego judge went on to the rulemaking, and that's what was the linchpin for her decision.
Right. I guess I'm not real sure what you're asking, but...
I'm asking, how clear can this be if you have the circuit court judge that says it's unclear, you have the district court judge in San Diego that's unclear, the 1994 clarification that says we're getting a lot of questions, the 1995 clarification that says we continue frequently to get questions. Isn't it difficult to maintain that it's clear and unambiguous?
No, I don't believe it is, Your Honor. I don't believe it is, and that is, and I think the San Diego Gas judge hit the nail on the head where he said the reading that the clarifications put onto the rule that was passed by regulation, it eliminates the second clause of the test and pretends it's not there. So I can't accuse an agency of being dishonest, but I can tell you there's an entire body of case law, some of which I cited in my brief, which I thought were the most important cases where agencies repeatedly try rewrite a rule and the courts say, no, you can't do that. If you want a new rule, then you have to rule make. And we all know what would happen if they actually tried to rule make this single layer testing. Okay, everybody comes out of the woodwork, every public interest group, there's an opportunity for comment, there's scientific investigation, and that's part of our democracy, and it's also part of safety. Because the agency is in a much better position than any of us here today to determine what is really necessary for public safety, to do a cost-benefit analysis, and to make all of those determinations. If this were a law school class or a high school class or a college class and I were teaching, I'd say, let's see a show of hands. Who here knows whether it's really safe or not to combine the layers, which results in less wall material being identified as asbestos-containing and therefore in need of abatement? Who would know? I don't think any of us here today knows.
Counsel, that gets me to my question. Isn't this a case about deference and deference to the agency? I mean, aren't we dealing with the proposition that an agency's interpretation of its own rule is to be given controlling weight deference unless it's contrary to the clear language of the rule? Isn't that the standard we're supposed to be following on review?
Everything after the unless, okay? Because I would submit that this is not a case of agency deference. When the court determines that the agency has done an actual interpretation as opposed to making a new rule under the guise of interpretation, then you owe deference to the agency if you really determine as justices that they are just interpreting. But the initial determination that the court makes as to whether the agency is really trying to rewrite the rule without rulemaking or whether they are truly interpreting, that's de novo. And in that aspect, there's no deference owed to the agency. And that is really, Your Honor, the heart of some of my argument, which is that, and in the cases I cited, you see the agencies doing this all the time. And I think we can know why. Rulemaking is an exhaustive ordeal. It takes a lot of time. The agency might not get the rule it necessarily wants because, you know, everybody gets involved, everybody gets notice and opportunity to be heard. So in this regulation, the agency is not interpreting, and I submit that this court owes them no deference. Okay, the agency is trying to rewrite a rule. And, well, how do we know that? Because, first of all, in both their clarifications, they say, oh, by the way, we're going to rule make this eventually. Well, that tells you right there that they know that they're trying to make a new rule because they basically said so. And I think I cited the Caruso case in my brief where there was a regulation under the American Disabilities Persons with Disabilities Act that wheelchair patrons at a concert or something were supposed to have a line of sight to the stage. And the court, the Department of Justice, which was the agency that was in charge of that kind of thing, they were the ones who came up, well, there has to be a line of sight. And that had never been passed as part of the regulation. And the agency said, oh, well, this is just an interpretation. And the court said, no, it isn't. You're making a new rule. You can't make a new rule that way. You have to go through rulemaking. And
but as I understand what's at issue here, what is at issue here is what it means to combine these layers. And I understand the agency has put out what they call clarifications, which you call rulemaking, clarifications of what it means to combine. And is that creating a new rule, or is that explaining what the rule that's in place means?
Creating a new rule because they said so. In their clarifications, they say, this is not subject to judicial review, and we're going to eventually make a rule. Okay, so the industry, including my client, had no input into these clarifications. When the initial rule was made in November of 1990, they rule made that, and they did the proper democratic process of notice, opportunity to be heard, let's consider safety, and let's, as an agency, make that determination. Okay, that was rule made. But when they started with these clarifications, they're completely changing the rule. And that's our fundamental thesis, is they can't do that. And you know, I'm not saying the agency are bad people, but I'm saying is we know from the case law that agencies try to do this kind of thing all the time for whatever reason, good, bad, or indifferent, and the courts say, no, you can't do that. And that's what we're saying cannot and should not be done here. So I don't think it's a case of deference to the agency. And even in cases where you show deference to the agency, that only goes so far. When the agency basically eliminates part of the test that's in their own regulation, the deference stops, even if you think it's an agency deference case. You know, and that's what we have here.
If this were a deference case, agency deference case, does that automatically mean that it's EPA to whom we would owe deference?
Well, yes, because it was the EPA who passed the regulation and the Wisconsin DNR just adopted it. So I would say it would be deference probably to the EPA and the WDNR since the DNR, our state DNR, adopted it. So it's I'm not sure there's a distinction.
Well, do we adopt every, if we adopt a provision of federal rules, would we adopt every clarification? I mean, maybe formal amendments that are the same subsection, that sort of thing, but are we bound to adopt every clarification that comes along?
No. I did not research that for this briefing or preparing for the oral argument today, but in response to your question, my gut is, well, no, we adopted the original regulation, and the DNR would probably be within its ambit to say, well, we're not adopting the clarifications. I don't think they've, as far as I know, they haven't taken a position. Other than this lawsuit, they haven't taken a position whether they've adopted the clarifications or not.
Well, when we adopt rule of procedure that is substantially the same as a federal rule, we look to clarification of those federal rules. The clarification comes in opinions. And we look to them on the theory that you got the federal system interpreting the federal rule and therefore doesn't bind us, but we sure think they're persuasive. So why is that any different than in this case we are dealing with regulations?
Well, when it comes to an agency interpretation, I'm trying to remember the buzzwords in terms of the court deference, and I'm trying to remember if persuasive is the word when you're talking about deference to an agency interpretation. And it seems the question we're getting at here, both with your question and Justice Prosser's question, is how much deference does the DNR in Wisconsin have to show to the EPA when Wisconsin, you know, adopts a validly passed regulation by the EPA, then the EPA interprets it, and then is Wisconsin adopting that? That's a subtle point of law. I must confess, I did not look at that in any other briefing or in preparing for oral argument today.
May I ask you, counsel, on page 2 of your brief, and there will be rebuttal to this, you say the state admits that without the substantive changes to the interim method affected by the clarifications, it loses this case, and you go on a little bit. Is there really agreement on that point or not?
Yes. I mean, Mr. Grabishak said in oral argument before the trial court, and I think his exact words are, if you throw out the clarifications, you throw out the state test results. And without their results, there's no evidence of asbestos exceeding any regulatory threshold. And I think that Mr. Grabishak's statement was commendably candid, because the evidence in the record of this case bears out what he said and what I've been arguing all along, that because the state's test results that they used to hold HEI liable fell into three categories. Number one, single-layer testing where they never combined the layers. Okay, single-layer testing where they get more than 1% in a layer or two, but when they combined all the layers, as Mr. Knight testified you're supposed to do, they got less than 1%. The third category is they did what are called grab samples from debris piles after the renovation started, and they would grab a single layer of something that they admitted they knew was originally a multi-layered sample. So, and I was very, very careful. I took two or three or four depositions of everybody from the state who was involved in sampling and testing, and I walked them very carefully through that. And so Mr. Grabishak's statement is kind of the icing on the cake, but let me tell you, the cake's in the record, okay, because I asked all these people and got them to admit, because I knew where I was going with this case, and I knew what I was going to argue as to why the state's test results are totally invalid. Which brings up another issue. Mr. Grabishak admitted in the trial court, he admitted here today, and he admitted in every brief that he's filed, that They can only guess or speculate why our results originally came back less than 1% for asbestos, and the states and subsequent testing came back as more. Well, what you have in that situation then is dueling test results. And there has to be, to satisfy constitutional due process, some kind of rational means for accepting one over the other. Except that Mr. Grubishak is saying he can only guess or speculate as to why ours came back negative and his came back positive.
Well, if you did all those depositions, you know why. I mean, you just told us why. You said his came back positive because they used an analysis based on his rule interpretation. And I assume yours came back negative because your people did an analysis based on your rule interpretation, right?
Second half, no.
No.
By the second half, I mean the test results from EMSL Laboratory, they were directed to do it under what's called the modified method, which is yet another EPA publication, which basically follows the clarifications. I think it came out between the first clarification and the second. And that's called the modified method. It's EPA 600R93-116. And the testing laboratory is directed to do it under that, which means single-layer testing. And and their results that they sent back indicated that's how they did it.
They did every layer separately and just gave you, say, five separate reports without combining anything or averaging anything?
No. There's nothing in the record specifically other than they're being directed to essentially follow the clarifications, and other than sending results back saying we followed the clarification method, or in this case what they're calling the modified method, other than that, the results are what they are. And so essentially, I mean, as I pointed out in my brief, given the number of days of alleged violation in this case, my client was facing a $4 million exposure, all on the basis of dueling test results, and the state never took a deposition of anybody from EMSL. Now, keep in mind, the state has the burden of proof on this case if they want to hold somebody up for $4 million.
Counsel, if I may, just for clarification,
mm-hmm.
Who directs the labs to follow the single-layer testing procedure? You've used that a couple of times in response to Justice Rogensack's questions. They're directed to use that. Who directs them to use that?
In this case, the record indicates Herenda Enterprises sent the material to the lab. There's a sheet that's in the record that instructs them what method to use for their testing. And that's pretty standard, but we're confined to the record in this case, and that's basically what happened. Then the results came back. And
what is standard? Is it standard that the requesting party would designate what test procedure to use, or is it standard that the test procedure used is the single layer?
I think both. In other words, the in this case, and I'm talking about this case, the Herenda Enterprises sent the material with a sheet with directions. The directions said modified method, which essentially, as I said earlier, adopts the clarifications. The results that came back stayed on there that they used the modified method. Okay, and the state, so you have the results that come back that say less than 1%. You have the states that say greater than 1%.
And then, sorry, just for clarification, is the modified testing method the standard method? That is, follow the clarifications. Is that what you referred to as standard? Is it standard for labs to use that?
I'm not going to call it standard because it wasn't rule made.
So,
okay, that is what the testing lab said they did in this case. I'm not going to call it standard because it was a procedure that has never been endorsed by agency rulemaking.
Counsel, I'm confused. If the modified method, is that the same method that the state is arguing that should be used here?
Yes.
And that was the method that was done by Herenda, the first test results?
The testing laboratory on the first results to which Herenda sent the samples, which was a laboratory called EMSL.
So they were both done utilizing the modified method, correct?
That's my understanding, yes.
So as I understand it, maybe I'm missing something, and I just caught it as you were responding to Justice Bradley. Maybe I'm missing this. But as I understand it then, the argument isn't about the test that was done or the test that needed to be done or should have been done. The argument is about the results that came in from the first test versus the subsequent test. That's Am I getting that correct?
That's my second argument, but yes, you're getting it correct in the sense.
And if that's the case, and we're dealing with a strict liability rule, then maybe I'm missing something here. If this is strict liability and you can test after the fact and the test results utilize, or the test method utilized both before and after the demolition was the same test, and the subsequent results come back and say that there's a violation, doesn't that end the case?
Well, no, because you have a set of test results that are unimpeached that say that there is no detail, or there is no regulatory threshold, there is no greater than 1%.
Well, they're not really unimpeached if you got the state saying they got test results that are contrary. So I think the most you can get is there's a question of fact about whether, in fact, the level of asbestos was higher or not higher.
I would submit, Your Honor, you can't resolve, you can't find issues of fact based on speculation.
Well, why is it speculation when two labs do a test on the modified method and they come up with two different results? What's speculative about that?
Well, Mr. Gabryshek said it's speculative. It's speculative to say that the state's test results were done properly and ours weren't. That's complete speculation.
Well, maybe the states were done improperly and yours were done properly. But, I mean, doesn't it still require someone to talk to the persons who did the test to find out what occurred?
If I were the state, I would have taken EMSL's deposition because I had extensive conversations with EMSL. I know what they were going to say, and I know there would be no guesswork and speculation. But what they did was the state's entire thesis is, we don't have to pay attention to your test results. Ours found asbestos, and therefore you're liable. That's not what strict liability is. That's like if a wheel falls off a car, strict liability, yes, but you have to prove that the wheel was defective because the manufacturer is not an insurer.
Right, right.
Well, it's the same thing here. If you have a set of test results, which we have, that are unimpeached other than by a different set of test results that are inconsistent with that, you can't. The trial court gave the state summary judgment based on that.
You know, I must have missed the boat on this case because when I read all this stuff, I wasn't thinking that your tests were done by the same method as their tests. I thought the argument was you guys didn't find it because you didn't read the rule right and you didn't do the tests right. And now what you're telling me is you use the modified method and they use the modified method, but you got two different results. That's a very different case.
Well, no, I have two arguments. One is that nobody can be held liable on the basis of the clarifications because they weren't rule made. And the state's entire thesis under which they held us liable and under which the trial court granted summary judgment was clarification method testing. The facts are uncontroverted that if they'd combined those layers on their tests, it would have been less than 1%. That's one argument. My second argument is even if you accept the clarifications or the modified method as the validly enacted rule, then you have to say, okay, well, you had our test results done under that procedure that said no detect for espresso, and it's really not over 1%, and the states it says yes, there was. And what the trial court did was, based just in her findings of fact and conclusions of law, just laid out the test results and then said, I'm holding you liable. And I argued throughout the trial court, here today, in the Court of Appeals, that you can't do that.
Well, I'm having the same problem that Justice Rogenstack is having, and I guess part of the problem that I'm having is if your position on your first argument is that no one should be utilizing the test results based on the clarifications, and yet that was the test that was done, that means, in effect, you're saying that there was no initial test done under the regulations before the demolition occurred.
Well, no.
That would be the net effect of your argument.
No, see, the clarification method testing, Your Honor, is always going to find more asbestos than the regulation is written, okay? Because under the clarification method, any one layer over 1%, you're done. Whereas under the regulation as passed, you can combine them and you might end up, which is exactly what happened here with the state's test results, is you get less than 1%.
Well, it's not just that you can combine them, it's that you are to combine them under the rule.
I'm sorry?
You are to combine them under the rule.
right?
Yes.
It's not just that you can combine them. It's that you are to combine them under the written rule. But under the clarification test, each layer is tested, right?
Well, each layer is tested under both. Okay.
But you combine them under the only rule that exists.
Under the valid rule, you combine them. But in this, it doesn't. If modification or clarification method testing is done, and that's all that's done, and you don't combine the layers, you're
always going to get a higher result.
What's that?
You'll always get a higher result under that.
Right. So you're not going to abate anything that shouldn't, that shouldn't be. And so, in other words, you're going to get less asbestos abatement if you combine the layers in some instances.
Only if you average them, and only if you combine layers that don't have asbestos in it, as well as those that do have asbestos in it. Right. If you'd run tests on each layer, and then you combine the layers with asbestos. In no averaging, you're going to get a higher result. So the rule, I think, why can't you say you only combine the layers where there is asbestos?
I'm sorry.
Well, you're trying to keep the concentration of asbestos down for the worker. That's the whole point of the rule, right?
Yes.
Okay. So if you're trying to keep the concentration of asbestos down for the worker, why would you want to combine something that doesn't add to the concentration? A layer with nothing in it doesn't add to the concentration. But if you just added the layers that have asbestos, you'd be then trying to assess the concentration that the worker is subjected to, right?
Well, that's what the agency has to determine. And that's what I'm saying why we're in the wrong forum. Under the rule that the agency wrote, you combine.
Yeah, but you're saying combine an average. And you're also saying combine any layer that you test. But the rule doesn't say that.
Well, yeah, it does. It says you combine the layers. It doesn't say you combine the layers with asbestos.
It doesn't say you combine the layers without asbestos either.
No, it just says you combine the layers.
But if you look at the purpose of the rule, it's to assess the concentration of asbestos. You can't assess it by combining it with something that has no asbestos in it.
Well, yeah, you can, because you're looking at a sample of multi-strata material.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But, your questions go to my whole point, is that this is an agency rulemaking function.
Uh-huh.
Okay, they're the ones who have to determine what's safe and dangerous. We can't make that determination here today. None of us is equipped. We're confined to the record on appeal, and we're deciding one case and one controversy.
I have one last question. I'm sorry to bug you, because I know your light is on, and counsel is anxious to get up there and respond again. If, in fact, you interpret the rule as you've argued in your brief, okay, that you combine every layer, asbestos in it or not, and then you average it. Why did you have the company do the test the other way?
Well, I don't think there's anything in the record on that. I was not even around when the samples were taken and sent to the laboratory.
Right.
I came in when a lawsuit got filed.
See.
There's nothing in the record, okay, as to why it was designated to use the modified method.
It sounds like maybe your client, whoever sent it over, interpreted the rule differently than you're interpreting it for a legal argument, doesn't it?
No, I don't think that they're directing the lab to use a certain method is not a statement that they endorse that method or that they think they can be held liable for $4 million on the basis of that method.
Okay. All right. Thank you
Thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you, counsel.
I guess I have about 5 minutes to tell you what I consider the rest of the story. Mr. Rattan began with John Knight, the state's witness, who supposedly admitted that you average these various layers. Well, that's really not so. When you look at his testimony, he testified that the state lab of hygiene reports two results, an average number based on the average of the layers and a result for each individual layer. And he testified that then he allows the client or the customer to decide which result to use. He was confused by the rule. That's why he said that's why they do that. Now, I can tell you that the state, and it's in the record, the state lab of hygiene is an accredited lab. In the record is the fact that NAVLAP, the accrediting agency, requires laboratories to use the guidance when they're doing this type of test. And I can tell you also that in terms of John Knight, he was a fact witness. He wasn't an expert witness. He was the one who did the lab analysis in this case. That's why he was a witness and deposed. Fact witnesses don't tell courts how to interpret rules. He wasn't an expert in interpreting rules. He wasn't an expert in the rules. He was an expert in looking at samples and counting asbestos fibers. That's what he was an expert in. Okay, the second sentence that's in the brief. Yeah. Going right up to the edge. The state admits, without substantive changes to the interim method affected by the clarifications, it loses its case. No, I don't admit to any that there's a substantive changes to the interim method by the clarifications. I don't admit that at all. What I have to admit, and what I do admit, is that if you average the layers in the sample, all the samples in this case, you end up with 1%. Because there was so the layers were thick enough to give you less than 1% in all the samples taken in this case, all of them. And so it's true that if you don't look at each individual layers, the state doesn't have a case. That's true. But the state believes you have to look at individual layers. Dueling test results. The state didn't even bother to pose the lab that they used. Now, Mr. Rattan suggests that the lab was, EMSL was told to use the modified method. But when you look at their test results, it's clear that they tested multi-layered material, but only gave one result. There's no individual, they're suggested in the results that they looked at multi-layers, but gave one result. So it tells you that they probably averaged them. Why didn't I go depose them and find that out? Because it wouldn't matter. Because then if I did, what would happen was that they'd go, well, we tested a different area than you. Or maybe they did test a different area then. Even the state samples, every one didn't come back asbestos-containing. I think it was 5 out of 10 of the state and 6 out of the 10 that was retested of our samples by Herenda came back hot. Not all of them did. Maybe by chance they hit areas that didn't have asbestos in it. I don't know. Maybe they didn't. Their samples didn't go all through all the layers like our samples did. I don't know. So it would have been a total waste of time to depose that EMSL.
Counsel, let me ask you, because maybe as I indicated to Mr. Rattan, maybe I missed something. If both parties provided the exact same tests in this case, and the only thing that's different is that the tests that were done pre-demolition came back not showing asbestos, and the tests coming back post-demolition showed asbestos, and we're dealing with strict liability here, why are we talking about whether or not there's rulemaking that took place in this case?
Because even under that second set of samples that were split in half and half given to Herenda, half we kept, all of them came, or 5 out of 10 of ours came back hot, 6 out of 10 came, theirs came back hot, those were individually layered tested. But I don't know what that first set was. I really just, you can't tell because the lab results suggest there's separate layers, but they only report one result, but they were told to use a different, a modified method. I can't explain it. But I can tell you, under strict liability, it doesn't matter. I mean, if a company could find some lab somewhere to always give them negative test results, essentially you could never prosecute an asbestos case, could you?
Why couldn't you have a question of fact and have the fact finder find out, like you do with any expert, whether they properly did what they were supposed to do when they made their assessment?
Because you can't, you're never going to have their test results and our test results be of the exact same location. You're never going to have necessarily the exact same depth. They're different samples. That's all you know is that they're different samples. When maybe that lab was perfect, maybe the sample was taken, I don't know, maybe they took it in different locations. If it's a strict liability statute, if you find asbestos, you have liability. Because you just don't, you got apples and oranges you're comparing there. And as I said, if the rule was that if, as long as a company comes up with a set of negative samples, they're okay, what a world we'd live in. I mean, we'd have...
I don't think it would say they're okay, but it could say that there's a question of fact that somebody has to resolve.
It could say, even if they were good faith, did their best to get the right spot, and did the best to do the best test, best results, under strict liability, it doesn't matter.
if you blew it, you don't have to show bad faith. You don't have to show intent. You don't have to show negligence. You just have to show it's there.
Well, if it's strict liability, shouldn't the rule be absolutely clear as to exactly what testing should occur?
And in this case, it's not. That's why the clarifications exist. And that's why the clarifications exist.
Clarifications are different than what the rule says. The rule says combine, and the clarifications do not. I don't disagree. The clarifications might be a safer way to do things if you want to produce the most safe environment. But shouldn't someone have notice as to what it is they're supposed to do?
You say that the rule says this and the clarifications say something else. I disagree with that, and I think all for all the reasons, you don't know what the rule says, and that's why you have the clarification. Okay. The rule is just unclear.
Okay, so there's no second part to the rule that requires combination of the results.
I'm not saying that. Combine. Tell me, I mean, as I don't want to rehash my argument. You don't know what the word combine means. You don't know which layers you're supposed to combine, whether it includes asbestos containing or non-asbestos containing.
Shouldn't the rule be redrafted so people know they have notice of what it is that's required of them so they can follow the rule?
Well, the EPA has admitted that eventually the rule should be redrafted to come closer to the clarifications, but in the interim session here, that's what we're talking about. You got to remember that these clarifications came in 95. We're talking, this case was probably, when they looked for materials and tested was 2003. And so it's not that long after the clarifications. Long enough, obviously, to put people on notice, not enough that labs would be required under NAVLAP to use the clarifications as a guidance.
Can I ask?
Sure.
You've talked about certified labs. Was this EMSL a certified
lab? I don't even know if EMSL was a certified lab. I do not know that. I know the State Lab of Hygiene was a certified lab. I believe the lab that was used by Mr. Herenda when he did the second, when they split samples with the state and also found asbestos, I believe that was a certified lab. Because of the problems of comparing apples and oranges, their samples to our samples, not knowing where those initial samples came from or how they were taken or how deep they were, so all I know is they were multi-layered and they reported one result, which right away pops up and goes, hey, something's wrong with this picture here. That's not the way our interpretation of the rule works, where you have multi-layers and you report one result.
How is a person who does demolition work, like the defendant here, to protect themselves when they do tests, find no asbestos, then the building's torn down, and after the fact, when they can't protect themselves anymore, the state finds asbestos because of the way the tests are done?
I can tell you that there, in my opinion, there are individuals who are running the backhoes, tearing down the second story plaster up there who should have been protected.
Oh, yeah. And I just say I agree with all of that. Okay, but what I'm looking at is how is the employer to know that that's required for the employees when they've done a test and the test that they've done didn't give them the results that you get post-demolition? I mean, how are they supposed to do what the regulations are for, which is to provide protection for workers?
Well, obviously, they have to be very competent at what they do. They have to use very competent labs. In this case, that didn't happen. It's a strict liability violation. I mean, again, the state doesn't have to prove bad faith. I'm not suggesting Herenda Enterprise was a bad person or did a bad job. Stuff happens sometimes.
I understand that. I guess my focus is really more on the worker, which is what's the person that's supposed to be protected, and assuming that the employer wanted to protect him, did the test, got negative results. You get the results that are bad after the test, but that still doesn't help the worker any.
I mean,
maybe the state should be out there doing tests before demolition or something.
Well, I think enforcement of the regulations, even on a strict liability basis, clearly sends a message to industry that they better be very good at what they do. They have to be careful. You better not hire the fly-by-night company to do your work. I mean, that's why there's strict liability for building owners. There's strict liability for general contractors. This is serious business. You can't escape sanction or retribution by saying, hey, I hired this guy. He said it was okay. It's not the way it's set up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ricciac and Mr. Rattan, for your arguments today in another environmental case that comes under a different kind of fact situation and regulation. That concludes our hearing in 05 AP 1829, State versus Horrenda Enterprises, Inc. The court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45, when it will continue its, with its October calendar. The court will meet in the conference room in closed session at 3:15. We are in recess.